You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Best Practices in Assessing Safety and Multidisciplinary Management in Relapse Refractory Diffuse Large B-Cell Lymphoma. Today, we'll discuss the use of novel therapies in the treatment of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and particularly the ins and outs of toxicity management with novel agents. My name is Lauren Scott, and I am so excited to host today's podcast, and I am really fortunate to be joined by Dr. Mehdi Hamadani. He is the Professor and Chief of Hematologic Malignancies and the Cancer Center Scholar, Endowed Chair at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and a world-renowned expert in lymphoma management. Hello, Dr. Hamadani. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Lauren. Thank you so much for inviting me and hosting me. Looking forward to the discussion today.
Great. So let's get started. Dr. Hamadani, you treat a lot of patients with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and you've seen a lot of changes over the years. Give us your perspective on systemic therapy for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. How has it changed over the past several years, and what's been the overall impact on your own clinical experience? You know, it was not long ago that all you had to work with was R-CHOP.
Very true, right? Over the years, I think our treatment options have expanded dramatically. If you look at the landmark trial led by the French group that led to the approval of R-CHOP, believe it or not, nearly 30 years ago, the control group that was treated with CHOP chemotherapy, their long-term cancer-free survival was probably in the 30% ballpark. And now with modern therapies 30 years down the road, we expect to cure more than two-thirds of the patients now. Because of availability of a number of active options, it wasn't long time ago, you are absolutely right, that our hope for cure used to be R-CHOP treatment. And among patients who had relapsed disease, the only curative options for those patients used to be a stem cell transplant. Now we have better, more targeted frontline therapies with ADCs getting incorporated on to the chemoimmunotherapy backbones. Among patients who fail frontline therapies, we have CAR T-cell therapies available in second line and beyond. We have three different antibody drug conjugates or ADCs available. We have bispecifics that are truly trailblazing options, rapidly moving to earlier lines of therapy. So it's a completely different therapeutic paradigm in 2025 compared to how the situation was in 1996, around the time when R-CHOP got approval in frontline setting.
It is really exciting. We've made tremendous progress. You've been part of this as you've been involved in many of the clinical trials, and you've, you know, watched the story unfold and seen how this works in your own patients. So, you know, this is great to talk to you about this topic. So we have both CD19-directed CAR T-cell therapies, and then we have CD20 by CD3 targeted bispecific antibodies, as you've mentioned. And these immunotherapies have both differences and similarities in their toxicity profiles. You're well familiar, obviously, with both modalities, and CAR T-cells are largely given in academic centers. But for a community center looking to bring in bispecific antibodies, what specific framework needs to be put in place so that they can implement step-up dosing and monitor and manage for CRS, ICANS, other toxicities?
So this is a really important question, right? Bispecifics are highly active immunotherapy drugs, but they do come with a steep learning curve. They have a very unique toxicity profile that is similar to the toxicities we see in patients getting CAR T-cell therapy. The main reason CAR T-cell therapies are done more in larger, often academic medical centers. And these toxicities are the cytokine release syndrome or CRS, ICANS or neurotoxicity, and infectious complications. Now, the good news is that the probability or chances of CRS or ICANS developing after bispecifics is substantially less than the profile after CAR T-cell therapy, which makes administration of these off-the-shelf immunotherapies more practical in community settings. But the safe administration of these drugs in the community setting requires a lot of planning. Bare minimum include training the physicians, the nurse practitioners, the nurses, the pharmacy staff, the services that you work with, like the ER physicians, the urgent care physicians, the ICU physicians, teaching them about what CRS is, how is it managed, how do you recognize it, how ICANS is managed. So developing what we call SOPs or standard operating procedures for monitoring, recognizing, and treating these toxicities is critical. And then disseminating that information across the various care teams that touch the patient is extremely important. The second part is, how do you administer these therapies? Are these going to be indefinite therapies inpatient, or are you going to do these therapies outpatient? That requires a lot of resources. If you're doing it outpatient, you have to think about a day hospital space. You have to think about availability of the drugs used to manage the toxicities of these immunotherapies being available in the outpatient setting. So a model that has at least worked in our part of the country is what we call a hybrid partnership between teaching hospitals and community centers. So what we typically do is, most of the CRS ICANS typically happens during the step up dose part, during cycle number one. So we partner with our physician colleagues in community settings, where we may do the first cycle in an academic medical center that is better equipped with monitoring, treating, diagnosing CRS and ICANS. And once these toxicities resolve, from second cycle onward, we transition those patients to the community setting. So there are many models out there. You have to think about what fits best for your practice. But bispecifics is a growing field. It's not just lymphomas. You have approvals in myeloma. You have approvals in small cell lung cancer. These therapies will get into community practices and will impact patient lives mostly in a positive manner.
I would imagine also the composition of the multidisciplinary team is expanded now that you have to deal with these new types of toxicities that you hadn't been dealing with when there was just R-CHOP, and also pre-medication. There's probably protocols for those. Are those specific to each cancer center, or is there a standard protocol that people should be following?
Yeah, so your point about multidisciplinary approach is very important, right? I'm going to share an anecdote from CAR T-cell therapy, right? Like 7-8 years ago, we were starting to do CAR T-cell therapies, and there was a patient of mine who received CAR T-cell therapy, and a couple of weeks later, he was in a community center where the ER doctor called me and he said, hey, your patient is having a stroke, and we are about to give the patient a drug to bust the clot. And I had to stop. I said, no, this patient is likely having neurotoxicity. This is not a stroke. It looks like a stroke. Please transfer the patient to our center. And he ended up having not a stroke, but ICANS that is treated with steroids, not a clot buster, right? So I think that case highlights how much important it is not only to educate the oncology team, but also engage your partners in the community, the ER doctors, the ICU doctors, the cardiologists. These things are of utmost importance. The second part of your question is pre-medication, and that depends on which immunotherapy platform we are talking about. In terms of cellular immunotherapies, like CAR T-cell therapies, there are some data, at least with the Axi-Cell platform, that pre-medicating patients with dexamethasone before CAR T-cell therapy, after CAR T-cell therapy, and the day after CAR T-cell therapy can mitigate the risk of CRS and maybe neurotoxicity as well. There are some other platforms for preventing these complications, which include prophylactic use of an IL-6 antibody called tocilizumab and an IL-1 antibody called anakinra in patients receiving cell therapies. The similar concepts are present in bispecifics as well. The most common approach is using dexamethasone prophylaxis in patients receiving bispecifics, and the dose, the frequency of dexamethasone varies a little bit across the various bispecifics, not only in lymphoma, but also in myeloma. So that is an integral part, particularly during the step-up dosing. In our institution, we also use during the step-up dosing of bispecifics, we use Tylenol as an antipyretic, and we also use H1, H2 blockers to reduce the probability of an allergic reaction in these patients. We also employ a modality of early intervention in patients who may be developing cytokine release syndrome. So we usually have a procedure where if somebody is getting glofitamab or epcoritamab as a bispecific outpatient, we instruct the patients to keep Tylenol and dexamethasone in pocket. If they develop a fever, our instruction to the patient is take the Tylenol and dexamethasone before you call us as a treatment for grade 1 CRS. By the way, grade 1 CRS is just fevers. And with that approach, we have shown that we can prevent hospitalizations in vast majority of our patients.
That's great information. Thank you so much, Dr. Hamadani. Let's turn our attention over to antibody drug conjugates. These are garnering a ton of excitement in many tumor types. In the last podcast, we talked about why we use them in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and we went through some of the targets. I'd be interested in hearing about the cytotoxic payload itself, whether it's MMA or PBD. How does that influence the spectrum and severity of toxicities that we observe when an ADC is administered?
Oh, this is a really, really important question, right? A lot of us don't realize that the major toxicity of the ADC comes from the payload or the toxin, not from the antibody. Of course, the antibody has some infusional toxicities, like an allergic-like reaction when you infuse the ADC, but the most of the toxicity comes from the payload. So for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, although we have three different antibody drug conjugates, we actually have only two payloads. So brentuximab vedotin and polatuzumab vedotin have the same payload. It's called MMAE. And loncatuximab tesirine has a different payload called pyrrolobenzodiazepine or PBD. Now, the toxicities of brentuximab and polatuzumab are actually very similar because the payload is similar. So what are the toxicities? The main thing we worry about is called neuropathy. So we monitor patients for peripheral sensory or motor neuropathy. A trick that I tell my physician partners is never forget to check the ankle reflexes on your patients who are getting brentuximab vedotin, because the first sign of neuropathy in these patients is loss of deep tendon reflexes. Do not ignore sensory neuropathy, particularly when it is starting to become painful. It's very important to hold the drug till the pain resolves and then restart at a lower dose. So problem number one with MMAE is neuropathy, and I would say problem number two is also neuropathy. Problem number three is myelosuppression. These drugs don't cause a lot of neutropenia. I actually see more thrombocytopenia than low white cell count or neutropenia. Those are easy to manage. Neutropenia can be managed with growth factor support. Another trick to do is sometimes, although this is off-label and I acknowledge it, sometimes if you change the interval of brentuximab vedotin from every 3 week to every 4 week, the degree of myelosuppression becomes a little bit easier. And then occasionally you may see some AST, ALT elevation or mild liver function abnormalities with these drugs, but those are generally manageable with dose reductions. On the other hand, loncatuximab tazarine has a different payload. It's called PBD. The toxicities are very different. For some reason, the PBD toxin causes and makes your patient very sensitive to sunlight. Anybody I start on lonca, I beg and instruct the patients, please watch the sunlight, wear sunscreen, cover your body, because you can get a really, really impressive photosensitive rash with these drugs. In fact, my patients who drive, they may have covered skin, but your hands are exposed to sunlight when you're driving on the steering wheel and you'll get a rash there. So I tell patients, please wear a driving glove when you're driving. The other thing that lonca can do is fluid accumulation. It's mostly edema in the legs, but in more advanced cases, you can see effusions or ascites. You're supposed to give your patients dexamethasone the day before, the day of, and day after lonca infusion. And it's very important not to forget it because it substantially reduces the chances of edema or fluid accumulation. And the third and main toxicity is you can see liver number abnormalities. I've never seen liver failure with lonca, but it does impact elevations in AST and ALT. A trick that I've learned over the years is that we don't routinely do gamma-glutamyl transferase or GGT measurements, but I always check them with lonca because even before your AST, ALT goes up, typically GGT goes up. And if you see that go up substantially, I would recommend holding lonca because if patients develop AST, ALT elevation, it actually takes a very long time to get better. But these are the three main toxicities with lonca. Photosensitive skin rash. Number two, fluid accumulation. You can prevent it if you don't forget about the dexamethasone prophylaxis. And then liver number abnormalities, not so much liver failure. And I highly recommend monitoring the GGT levels when you're doing blood counts on your patients.
Thank you for that very important, very practical information. In the trials and in your own experience, what are the differences in toxicities when you use Pol-R-CHP versus R-CHOP?
So I often refer people to look at the toxicity plots in the Polarex trial. They had a very nice figure where they developed a butterfly plot that looked at the frequencies of various toxicities between Pola-R-CHP and R-CHOP, and they're fairly comparable. The risk of neuropathy, including painful significant neuropathy, is very similar because vincristine causes as much neuropathy as does polatuzumab. And at the end of the day, polatuzumab is actually glorified vincristine, right? Their MMAE basically works like a vinca alkaloid. The degree of myelosuppression is comparable. You may see a little bit more neutropenia with Pola-R-CHP, but if you routinely use growth factor support, it is often not that difficult. The probability of neutropenic fevers is very similar. So I do not find Pola-R-CHP to be a more toxic regimen.
That's very helpful. Let's move on to the relapse refractory setting. Patients are often more worn down by their disease and the treatments they receive once they get to later lines of therapy. Do you have any recommendations for successful management of toxicity? Let's, go through some of the specific antibody drug conjugates and other options in the relapse refractory setting.
Yeah, it depends, right? So the relapse refractory patients, like frontline patients, their performance score, organ function score, bone marrow reserves are very different, right? In older, frail patients with limited bone marrow reserve, all of these treatments are difficult to give. I think a setting that is challenging is relapse patients with prior cell therapies like CAR T cell therapies. Those patients have very resistant disease. Unfortunately, because of CAR T cell therapy, they often have relatively incomplete bone marrow blood count recovery that makes administrations of more myelosuppressive treatments relatively difficult. I think choice of your therapy also kind of depends on pre-existing complications as well. So I'm going to give you an example. Let's say if you had a patient who had significant peripheral sensory neuropathy because of EPOC or R-CHOP treatment in the frontline, they obviously will not be great candidates for polatuzumab in second line. So for those patients, if available, tafa-len or lonca-based approaches may be more attractive. In patients who have evidence of pre-existing effusions, like pleural effusion, naturally loncatuximab will become less attractive. Patients with impressive history of venous thromboembolism, lenalidomide-based regimens like tafa-len becomes less attractive. So you're right, prior therapies do play, and the toxicities of prior therapies sometimes help us pick a treatment. Comorbidities help us pick a treatment, right? A good example is a diabetic patient with severe autonomic or motor sensory neuropathy. Again, pola becomes a less attractive option. A cirrhotic patient with liver problems will sway you away from loncatuximab in those settings. So I think these are some of the things we think about beyond labels and indications of how to pick one regimen over another based on our estimates of what may be more tolerable from a side effect profile for the patient.
That's great. I think that's your expertise is so useful here. Thank you. Do you have any other pearls of wisdom, Dr. Hamadani, in terms of managing toxicities in patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma?
The part where toxicities are unique are bispecifics and cell therapies. I think rather than a pearl of wisdom, a caution would be the learning curve in learning how to manage hypogammaglobulinemia, CRS, or ICANS. So I think that's a point where we already talked about developing treatment pathways of how to recognize, diagnose, and treat these complications is important. Educating your team as well as your consulting and collaborating services is very important. I have no doubt that eventually we will get these cellular immunotherapies, hopefully by specifics before CARs in community settings, where patients will have access to these, I think, sometimes curative treatments near their homes, rather than having to travel to large academic centers away from their home. And the key barrier is learning how to deal with these complications.
Dr. Hamadani, this was wonderful and so informative. That's all the time we have today, unfortunately, but I would like to thank you for taking the time to speak with us about the nuances of toxicity management in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And thank you to our audience for joining us. We hope you found this information to be useful for your clinical practice. I would like to give a special thank you to our supporters, ADC Therapeutics America, Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and Pfizer, who provided educational grants for this activity. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group, who in support of improving patient care is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center. To provide continuing education for the healthcare team, this CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials.